This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You know, we had breakfast with the secretary along with some other bloggers, and even sitting down, he's a very tall man.
He is a very tall, good-looking man, too. And he wears his suits well. He does. You and him got a lot in common.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Charlie Sheen of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. Mike, I don't know that there's two ways to interpret that. One is that even in the throes of his drug-addled confusion, Sheen has apparently been showing up to work every day, doing a good job, knocking it out.
That's how I mean it. Yeah.
The other way is that the guy is clearly off the rails. In fact, did you see
I mean it that way too. Oh, actually, it's so perfect.
Did you see this quote he gave the other day?
Well, let's hear it.
Right, his Sheen's statement was this: "Yeah, I am on a drug. It's called Charlie Sheen. It's not available because if you try it once, you will die. Your face will melt off, and your children will weep over your exploded body. Too much." I'm like, wow.
I mean, come on, Rick. None of us could imagine you ever saying something like that, right? I mean, it's perfect. You're like, you're brothers.
You know what? The irony is that I believe the Secretary of Education said something very much like that to you this morning when you asked what's it like to be the secretary.
That's right. That's right. And what did he say?
He said, Mike, being the secretary would make your face melt off.
Oh, you know, we had breakfast with the secretary along with some other bloggers. And, you know, even sitting down, he's a very tall man.
He is a very tall, good looking man, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he wears his suits well.
He does.
You and him got a lot in common, except that he's a lot taller.
Yeah, I was going to say. So he's got like a foot on me.
And it was funny. Peter Cunningham was right there looking a little bit like a consigliere.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's exactly what he is.
He was like, hey, I don't know about that, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And David Hoff, you know, once upon a time would have been on the other side of that table.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. All right. Lots to cover today. Plenty happening in the world of school reform. We'll, of course, play part in the gadfly. Daniela will be here to ask the questions. We'll hear Amber's Research Minute, and we will hear Chris's What's Up With That? So let's get started. Daniela, pardon the gadfly.
Okay. Question number one. Right now we're seeing three models of GOP governors. We've got Christie, the demagogue, Daniels, the kind of middle of the roader, and Walker, the hardliner. Which is the best model?
So what do you think, Rick? Do you have a fan? Are you a fan of one of these in particular?
I'm a fan of all three. I got to say, the most interesting thing is that Daniels has gone from being the bleeding edge of hard-hitting Republican governors to just being described as kind of the moderate one in a span of 4 months.
Well, elections matter, right?
You know, the most interesting thing, I think that there are three flavors of something that's really neat. And that the really neat thing is we're finally having a serious principled debate about how you do school reform. You know, for the last decade, we had bipartisanship in the sense that the Republicans agreed to be for more money, more federal regulation, and to argue about who was most guilty about the state of low-income schools. And what we're now seeing is Republican leadership talking about, you know, needing to save dollars, needing to revisit oversized benefits, really needing to take not just a scalpel, but really a machete to some of the real problems with these systems. And I think they're doing it in three different ways. And I think there's something to be said for all of them.
You know, I've been so interested in watching the reaction among Democratic education reformers to what's happening in Wisconsin. And you and I both commented on this on our blogs. You know, you have to wonder, are they really as upset? I mean, you said that Joe Williams and Andy Rotherham were crying crocodile tears over the happenings in Wisconsin. Clearly, this is good for the education reform movement to have these guys coming out with the nuclear option, putting the unions up against the wall. And suddenly a lot of other things look much more reasonable.
You know, it's great. You know, it's great for the DFER types on two counts. One, suddenly, you know, hey, doing some give backs on benefits and maybe rethinking teacher termination suddenly looks like a much more moderate stance. And B, it suddenly gives all our progressive friends an easy opportunity to go and rally the troops and say, see, we're all Democrats at the end of the day, and this is what sets us apart. It gives me a huge opportunity for Clinton-style triangulation.
Right. So they should thank us.
They should at least thank Walker.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I guess we haven't actually done anything. Okay. Topic number two.
Wake County's back in the news. The charged debate over integration has actually mellowed now with a new proposal to integrate schools by achievement levels instead of socioeconomic status. What's the likelihood that this is going to succeed?
All right. So this, I mean, on the substance, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, there is research that shows that if you have a high concentration of low achieving kids in the same school, they're going to achieve even worse than they would if they were kind of spread out around the place. This is similar as saying, you know, high concentrations of poor kids is not good. And by the way, of course, poor kids are the ones most likely are the ones that are low achieving. So Wake County is trying to find a way to get, you know, they've moved beyond race, now moved beyond socioeconomic status, talk about achievement. Still, you got the same basic problems, which is that, you know, it's going to be pushing some kids, especially the higher achieving, wealthier kids, away from their neighborhood schools and away from the schools where they might want to go.
I mean, I got to say, if I'm a parent of a kid who's proficient in Wake County, this totally pisses me off. You're now telling me that because you want my high achieving kid in a school to help balance the ratio, that you're going to probably limit my options in a public choice scheme to send my kid to schools that have high concentrations of high achievers, and you're going to disproportionately steer me into schools that have high concentrations of low performers. This is not something calculated to make me want to buy a house or stay in Greater Wake County.
So it makes me wonder, though, that if the reaction has been more positive than to the other plans, I would like to see the data. Maybe it is such that this is less restrictive than just going on socioeconomic status, because perhaps the argument is there's actually a fair number of poor kids who are proficient, and so it's easier to hit these ratios than it was just to hit the SES ratios.
That could be.
All right. Topic number three.
Let's hope. Topic number three. Today, Fordham released a survey of Ohio superintendents. Mike, what were the findings? And then, guys, what do they mean?
All right. So interesting findings. This survey by Steve Farkas and Duffett, very excellent survey researchers, looked at how superintendents in Ohio feel about both the collective bargaining stuff going on, the budget cuts, other flexibilities they need. The basic storyline is they're saying, hey, we desperately need more flexibility. If we're going to get through this financial crisis, we need more flexibility, especially over our staff. They support changes to collective bargaining. They're saying that it's killing them, and that they want to have more flexibility in how they manage the personnel. Now, this is what they say to survey researchers behind closed doors anonymously. It is similar to what our team will hear when they talk to these folks behind closed doors. But very few of these superintendents have been willing to come right out and say it out loud at a school board meeting or in the state legislature.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the timidity and the lack of leadership shown by school boards and superintendents on this stuff has been astonishing. Right. I mean, superintendents have rarely gone to the table and insisted that when they renegotiate contracts, that they earn this flexibility. Few superintendents have gone to their school boards, either upon being hired or when considering contracts, to really make the issue to fight for it. In Wisconsin, we see the Superintendents Association bad-mouthing and poor-mouthing the savings from benefits, saying, well, yes, we're hugely cash-strapped and we say we need more money, but we're not really going to save that much off pensions and health care, and it's going to create a fuss. So
wait,
really,
don't they get those same pensions and health care?
Actually, you know what? So there's two interesting things here, right? One is a degree to which the management is actually on the same side as labor,
yeah,
when we're dealing with these things. But the second thing is, realistically, from their perspective, you know, they can say that they'd like savings, but they really just want is more free money. They don't want to have to do anything unpleasant.
All right. Well, what we did ask in this survey is we did push on that a little bit and said, you know, look, which is more important, more money or more flexibility? And they were very clear. They said more flexibility.
So how often in, you know, since you guys have been actively engaged in Ohio, which is more than a decade,
right,
have we seen the, you know, school administrators really going to Columbus,
right,
and banging the table and fighting hard for,
right,
flexibility?
Yeah,
how often does that happen?
But it was exciting.
How often does it happen, though?
Well, it's happened a couple weeks ago for the first time ever.
But never prior to that.
That's right. And so, you know, a couple of superintendents did stand up at the hearing for the Senate Bill 5.
And how many soups are there in Ohio?
611.
And how many would you say really stood up for this?
Well, I think a couple of them testified.
Two, maybe?
And something like that. They came out of, I think, you know, more Republican stronghold parts of the state of Ohio. Perhaps the districts where Boehner represents them. But they stood up and the point
two out of 600.
Two out of 600. The point is the other 600 feel the same way that those two.
Did they write a public letter supporting the two that were testifying?
Generally, no.
Have they?
But they did give these answers in a survey.
An anonymous survey, right, where they could hide. I mean, you know, this is the problem.
Look, I agree, Rick. And the thing in Ohio is a lot of this stuff is in law. I mean, last in, first out is in state law. Senior salary. single salary schedules is in state law. Even the number of sick days, they have to give 15 sick days.
That's you guys have been, law. Fordham has been writing about this in Ohio for years and years.
Right.
In that time, as you guys have brought these things to attention, you did your analysis of the huge problems with pensions in Ohio. How frequently have the superintendents or the Superintendent Association really stood up, strongly endorsed this, and gone to Columbus to support these changes?
I don't like your glasses half-empty attitude here. The point is, what we are finally seeing is the superintendents are starting to show some courage.
Which will last exactly as long as the greatest economic downturn in 75 years.
Yeah, well, let's take advantage of it. That's fine. We're not saying this is, this is a survey that we're saying, we love superintendents, they're great. We're saying, hey, superintendents are saying to us, they need this flexibility to run their organizations
better. I'd like to see more than two say it in public, and I'll start to have more confidence.
All right. Well said, well played. Whew, that was heated. I love it. You know, Rick, it's amazing. You seem like you hate administrators, and yet they invite you to speak all the time. It's like sadomasochists. They just invite you in to get slapped around. Very interesting. Anyway.
It's brutal in book sales, I will say that.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Next up is Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, what do you think? Did you agree that Rick Hess is the Charlie Sheen of the education policy world?
Oh, man, no, absolutely 100% agree.
Yep.
Craziness. Mm. Boy, I feel sorry for him, though. But, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but he's got the most tweet followers, like a million.
Huh?
And he got him in 2 hours or something.
Yeah.
He holds the Guinness Book on the number of followers in the least amount of time. I saw this on my
That's little, great. I've been trying to think about how to get my tweet followers up.
Yeah.
And he really shows the way, huh?
Yeah. Just have some goddesses live with you. That's what it takes, apparently.
Nice. Well, who says I don't have goddesses?
Yeah, this is true. I've met Megan.
All right. So what do we have today?
All right. So we are well aware that students are required to be tested in science periodically, but that the results don't count in AYP calculations. So one wonders, how much science do kids know? So at the risk of you guys taking a snooze, we have science achievement results on the NAEP for 17 major urban school districts that volunteered to take the test. These are the TUDA results. So these are results, they aren't representative of all urban districts, but obviously of the ones that volunteer to participate. So questions measure students' knowledge in physical life, earth, and space science, and achievement results are rendered on basic, proficient, and advanced. I see you snoozing already. Shockingly, most of the students in these districts at both grade 4 and 8 scored lower than the national average.
Oh, you don't say.
I'm shocked. Hey, you know, some weeks are better with others and studies around here. Anywho, Charlotte, Jefferson County, Kentucky, and Miami-Dade came closest to the national average. In Austin, eighth graders performed at or above proficient in advance. They were higher, basically, than large cities, and so Austin came out pretty good. Bad news, another shocker, Baltimore, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Fresno, LA, Milwaukee, and Philly had the worst overall results. And then we get the really bad news, which honestly, I look at the table and thought, is that a typo? Cleveland and Detroit had just 4% of their students reach proficiency in science. Baltimore had 5%, Philly had 8%. And then there was a bunch of data about achievement gaps, basically between black and white students. It ranges from 26 points in Philly to 56 in Atlanta. We know that these results can't be compared to previous frameworks because it's a new framework. Finally, though, I did take a look at some of the sample questions to see what these newest advancements in science were that were being captured. And it was a little jarring. So I'm wondering if you would permit me to read one sample question.
I will give you the floor.
I know that this is boring, but it gets a little more interesting look at a sample question. Yeah. Real quickly, Jamie and Manuel visit the zoo. They see two male tigers who are brothers. Jamie points out that the fur of one of the tigers has stripes that are darker brown than the other tiger's stripes. Manuel says those tigers can't be brothers. How can Jamie explain to Manuel that tigers with different colored stripes can be brothers? So you think maybe this is some cutting edge genetic science.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Asking the kids, how can these tigers of different stripes be brothers?
Yeah.
What cutting edge science?
Yeah.
A right answer?
Let's see.
I have very light skin. My sister has darker skin, but we're brother and sister. There you go.
That was going to be my answer.
Winning answer. Boom. Right there. Full credit for that one.
I hope that was fourth grade.
That was fourth grade. But I mean, even at fourth grade. Fourth grade? Come on. Can we expect a little bit more?
That's science? How is that science?
That is a life science. That's the life science category. So cutting edge genetic science, people.
All right. Now, let me ask you a couple questions. So we always see that Charlotte and Austin, for example, do well in these tests. And I've always assumed that that's partly because of demographics.
That's
right. You know, these are places where there are more, you know, middle class white students who generally perform better. But then Miami-Dade is interesting that they ended up on the list. I mean, I think of Miami as a very poor area. I guess it is a countywide system. But, I mean, can we figure, is there any way that people can really figure out, you know, hold for the demographics, do some regressions and figure out, you know, are any of these cities doing better than you expect because of their demographics?
Yeah, I mean, NAEP doesn't obviously do that. I mean, they have a little chart that says their white kids score higher than other white kids in the nation, of which that is you know, the truth for some of these cities. But yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously possible to do. It's just not something that NAEP takes it upon itself to do.
Yeah. Well, I think we should do it. And as our research director,
another study, because we don't have enough around here.
I know. But it is, I mean, it does strike me, you wonder, you know, Florida reforms have gotten a lot of attention. You look at the NAEP results statewide, and yeah, I mean, Florida's minority kids, especially Latino kids, are doing much better than other Latino kids in other parts of the country. Yeah. They're doing better than all kids in some states.
And that's actually been well researched and documented.
So you wonder about in Miami, you know, and does, again, Jeb Bush get some credit for what happened statewide having an impact on the scores in a place like Miami-Dade? Seems like it's worth further study.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes. And then, of course, there's Charlotte and Austin, which, again, it may just be demographics. These are also places, though, where the teacher unions do not bargain collectively.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
An interesting tidbit in light of everything that's happening. Okay, so Amber, what's the song that goes along with this study?
So, since we're talking big cities today, we're going to go old school with Stevie Wonder singing Living for the City.
Oh, yeah.
A boy's born in hard-time Mississippi, surrounded by for world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city. His father works some days for 14 hours, and you can bet he barely makes a dollar. His mother goes to scrub the floors for many, and you best believe she hardly gets a penny. Living just enough for the city. Yeah.
You know, what's so perfect about this Stevie Wonder song is people at home can't see this, but Rick is wearing his Stevie Wonder glasses today.
You know
you
what?
Don't even notice
I never
it.
Took my clips off. How funny is that, babe?
Right.
I don't think the clips offer all that much UV protection.
Yeah, but Rick is through the whole show wearing his sunglasses. You don't realize this?
Well, you know what? Because they're not really sunglasses. They're clips over the glass kind of thing.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, Mike, I was thinking you looked nice and ruddy.
Yeah.
That's so much now is clear.
Oh, Rick. By the way, Rick did wear pants for the breakfast with the Secretary of Education today.
It's the right thing to do.
Though he is also wearing a martini shirt.
Not a martini shirt. It's a Beneker shirt.
With a picture of a martini on it.
Okay. I didn't realize that so much. But I think that was covered by the long sleeve shirt.
All right.
Probably.
That's true.
It may or may not.
All right. It's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes,
sir. Okay, Chris, what you got for us this week?
All right. Well, we've long heard the argument that 21st century American children on the whole are over-medicated. Forget flus, colds, and other immune system illnesses. I'm talking about the parent-driven affinity for doctors to bust out the RX pad and put any child showing signs of hyperactivity on a healthy diet of Ritalin. Tara Ashburn, an English teacher at Imagine Prep High School in Surprise, Arizona, is one of many who agree. In fact, she agreed strongly enough to voice her opinion on the matter, along with many others, in the form of a bumper sticker. However, this particular piece of expression landed her in the principal's office after some school parents began complaining about it. The sticker in question sarcastically asked, "Have you drugged your kid today?" After refusing to remove it from her car, the 7-year teacher was promptly fired by school officials. What's up with that? No, I'm not referring to the school's decision to fire her. I'm talking about Ashburn Osburn's decision to get sacked over the right to sport a sassy bumper sticker. I mean, come on, it's not even that witty to begin with. It'd be one thing if she held this opinion adamantly close to her heart and it was her only bumper sticker, but the backside of her car is littered with the things. You know the type, the car that triggers a collective eye roll from the drivers unfortunate enough to be stuck behind it at a red light. Osburn is currently fighting to get her job back, claiming a violation of her First Amendment rights. Freedom of speech? Please, this isn't the Daily Show. No one's paying for her social commentary. You don't have the right to say whatever you want while you're acting on behalf of an employer. Even Judge Judy could tell you that. So let's climb down off of our high horse, or our preachy compact in this case, and think about what's more important, impacting the lives of children on a daily basis, or being able to tell the world that too many of those children take Adderall.
Interesting. So, you know, first of all, there is the constitutional question here about the free speech. So they are saying that she was fired for driving her car with this bumper sticker onto school property.
Correct.
So if she had, say, parked, you know, a few blocks away and walked, that would have been okay.
Right.
Because then they would have known, obviously, she does have free speech rights to drive around with a bumper sticker saying whatever she wants it to say.
Absolutely.
More or less. But it's just the fact that she was parking that on school grounds.
Right. The parents were upset that, she had this displayed and, she's acting on behalf of, she works for the school district. She parks in the school's parking lot. They asked her to remove it from her car and, she turned it into a big issue. And
ironically is, I think this would stand up court scrutiny. The ironic thing is if she was a kid and she had that bumper sticker on her car and was parking in the student parking lot, I think the courts would say that the school could not ask that kid to take that bumper sticker down. Because unless it was promoting drug use or something, I think the current, so basically students have greater rights of free speech in our schools right now than teachers do.
This is like one of those ones where I'm mixed. I mean, I think those parents need to get a life. On the one hand, I'm worried about precedents which restrict the ability of, on the one hand, we lean on principals and superintendents to make sure that schools are safe places. We blow up when something goes wrong. So you understand, their need to placate the community and do what they can to button down. So I hate to come down for a precedent which is going to formally dial back their ability to control, the behaviors and expressions of folks who work for the district while on school grounds. But on the other hand, I'm like, come on, seriously? So I kind of got mixed feelings on this.
I actually swapped opinions on this when looking at it originally, because a lot of the media coverage out there is very, this woman's being denied her freedom of speech, and it's very pro the teacher. And the more I thought about it, the more I was thinking, put in her shoes, is it really worth getting your 15 seconds of fame and making a big stink, or, just take it off your car and get back in the classroom?
And look, we've had these debates before. Teachers should not expect, wide freedom of speech rights when they're acting in school on behalf of their employer. That's just the game. You don't get to say whatever you want to say to young people when you're getting a paycheck.
Same is true in any work environment.
Yeah.
If you go to a work environment and you're wearing a T-shirt that it offers a message which is inconsistent with what the organization's business is, there's going to be repercussions.
Right. But then the crazy thing is that we actually have many more rights for students around free speech.
Absolutely crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. So what I think our conclusion is fewer rights for everybody. That's the right way to go.
Where everybody needs to take a serious chill pill.
That's another way of saying it. All right. Thanks. That's the time we got for this show. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.